Today's guest is a journalist and himself the host of Pro MMA Radio, Larry Pepe. Thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, Jake. Pleasure to be on.
Cool. Yeah, I've said it before, but I urge people to go out. And download episode 10 and 36 of the unfortunately now defunct Filthy FRB show, where Front Row Brian, Tom Lawler, and Larry went deep into breaking down various doping violations, USADA, Anderson Silva, IV bans, all that fun stuff. And that's actually where I wanted to start this evening. How shocked were you 72 hours out from UFC 200 when the world found out that John Jones was pulled from the card, not because of a hit and run or alcohol related or drug related, but a PED related, a quote, potential USADA violation? How shocked were you when that news was handed down?
Yeah, you know, Jake, I was pretty shocked. I mean, in this day and age, it's hard to be shocked by anything after Anderson Silva. Like, for me, Anderson Silva failing his drug test was probably the turning point where I said, if Anderson can fail, Anderson, who looks like a stick figure, whose body hasn't changed over time in any significant way, who I thought was always kind of the example of technique trumps all. You know, technique trumps strength. It trumps that he fights guys who are twice his size, like Chael Sonnen and Chris Weidman. He's just so elite, so skilled at what he does, that he was that example for me. And when I woke up that morning and saw that he failed, I was like, okay, anybody can fail. So John failing in that respect was not as shocking for me as Anderson, but what did make it shocking was the timing, because you just sit there and you say to yourself, how can USADA be this incompetent that they can be doing drug tests that are putting the promotion in a position that days before the biggest event in UFC history, as it was billed, you're pulling the main event fighter off the card? And that, to me, was probably the more shocking part. John failing, surprising, sure, but in this day and age, I'm not sure how we can be too shocked by anybody failing, but the timing was really the more shocking aspect to me. Of course, not as shocking as when Brock Lesnar's test result from June 28th came back 17 days later, but I'm going to guess you're going to ask me about that at some point before we get done.
Yeah, you know, we may as well move to that question now. I think it was episode 413, and you were going deep into that test taking 17 days. You also brought up the old, I guess it's now almost forgotten story about the Belfort Jones fight, where the UFC may have known about a failed test and kind of kept it close to the hip. I'll let you dive deep into it, but tell us about the facet of this Lesnar story that you think the media might be conveniently skirting around.
Yeah, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, timing on some of these tests is concerning, and none more concerning than Brock's, because when you look at his June 28th test, it didn't come back until 5 days after, or 6 days after, the pay-per-view was in the books and the money was in the bank. And that's troubling to me. It should be troubling to every fighter, as it is obviously very troubling to Mark Hunt. It should be troubling to every media member, and it's clear that it's not. And the reason it's troubling is because simple math dictates that it doesn't make a lot of sense that a pre-fight test, that you know, if you're USADA and you are sending your inspector to do that collection, you know that this individual is stepping in the cage in 11 days. It's impossible to think that they could be that incompetent, which apparently they were, to not expedite that test. Now, to give USADA one benefit of the doubt, if you look historically at tests that are done at WADA-approved labs, there's only two WADA-approved labs in the United States. One is the Smertl lab in Salt Lake City. The other one is at UCLA. Customarily, blood test results take 2 to 3 days. Urine results take 6 to 9. So if you were USADA and you did not believe in, I don't know, doing things in a way that would ensure that you would get the results back, like expedite them, which is inexcusable. It is inexcusable, especially when you're not footing the bill, to not expedite every single drug test that is done within 3 to 4 weeks of an event of a fighter who's fighting. Because what is the point, really, of doing the test if it's not for sure going to come back before that person actually fights? It's not just to catch them afterwards. The idea is to protect the health and safety of the other fighter and the fairness of competition. You're not doing that if you do tests and don't get them back before they actually fight. Unless you're just doing a test like it's an extra test that you're doing 2 or 3 days before the event, you know it's not going to come back, but maybe you think that fighter is trying to game the system because they don't think they're going to be tested anymore. But this wasn't that. This was 11 days out. If the normal test is 6 to 9 days, and we don't even have to go historically, how about we look at Brock's fight night test, which was on the 9th, came back on the 19th. 10 days. If you use that exact same 10-day measure, then they would have gotten Brock's failed June 28th test the day before UFC 200, which would have been a disaster. The idea that no one is raising or asking, well, wait a second, his fight night test, which has no urgency whatsoever, because you're not getting that back no matter what you do before he fights, and you know that. So there's no urgency to that test. The test with no urgency gets back in 10 days, which is mysteriously very close to the 6 to 9 day history that I found for these types of tests. But the same test on the same guy pre-fight, which obviously has a sense of urgency, takes 17, and nobody's going to talk about that. Nobody's going to talk about that if there's one guy that kind of, from a stereotypical standpoint, personifies what you would be afraid of a 275-pound uber-athletic beast being on stuff fighting another person, if that's not going to raise people's consciousness, not only in the MMA media, but the mainstream sports media that was so concerned about a reporter's credential, but they're not concerned that Brock Lesnar, at 275 pounds, as strong and as athletic as he is, was able to get in a cage and beat another dude up when he had a dirty sample submitted 11 days prior. It's amazing to me that it is not getting a ton more of attention. And I've seen it said that it would be reckless to accuse them of having results ahead of time. It's not about accusing. It's about raising the question. How is the question not being asked? No one's saying that they knew for sure, but how you can look at these time frames as any media, any credible media, and not say, how in the world did this happen? And how can we make sure, how can we put enough pressure on the powers that be that medias are supposed to hold accountable, how can we make sure this doesn't happen again? Well, the way to make sure it doesn't happen again is to pressure them and embarrass them, because that's the only way things get done sometimes, into expediting every test that's done within 3 to 4 weeks of a fight. But that's not happening. That's not happening, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's unfair to raise the question when the UFC has done it in the past, done it within the last few years when we had the deal with Jones and Belfort. I mean, I guess if I'm USADA, is there any reason to speak up and say, hey, you know, we gave these tests back to UFC on X date. I don't know if, you know, there's any Freedom of Information Act there or anything, but I mean, if you are running the UFC and you're planning on selling the damn company within 24 hours, and you've gotten away with it before, and you're selling this UFC 200 card that's supposed to be the biggest card in the history of not just the UFC, but of the sport, and you're selling it around Brock Lesnar, and you find out a week before the fight that, he tested hot. I mean, I think any rational owner would look at, you know, the test and go, well, you know, we're rolling the dice huge, but we've done it before, we've gotten away with it before, you know, I laid the rest of that out. It's a very interesting question you're raising there.
Well, and I think this too, Jake. Like, you know, they wouldn't have had the result a week before. They probably would have gotten it within days if you look at the prior time frames, which would have put them in a position to potentially, if they got it, and I don't know, but again, you can't call yourself a journalist and not raise the question, for God's sakes, when the guy's own fight night test comes back in a time frame that would have mandated him being pulled from the card if his pre-fight test was done in the same time frame. So, you know, when you look at the timing, if it was 9 or 10 days, they literally would have gotten the result the day before or 2 days before the card, which would have been the day after they'd pulled Jones. So, obviously, it would have created massive issues. Did it happen? Who knows? But here's the thing. We know there's only two possibilities. Either USADA was straight up incompetent and didn't expedite his test, which is pretty clear at this point because it took 17 days. And why wouldn't you expedite them? I mean, common sense says the only people who wouldn't expedite them is, I don't know, maybe if you didn't want to know. Or you got the result. So either way, it's not a good look. And it's not just the UFC that has a history. USADA has a history. They governed the Eric Morales fight against Danny Garcia before they ever came on with the UFC. Eric Morales failed two drug tests, A and B samples. That's four dirty samples within 2 weeks of the fight. And Eric Morales fought. USADA apparently walked in on Floyd Mayweather before the Manny Pacquiao fight, after the weigh-in, and he either was getting or had just gotten an IV. That's a doping violation. He still fought, and they issued a, quote, retroactive therapeutic use exemption 18 days after the fight. So when you have two entities that historically have done things that are certainly don't pass a smell test, to not raise the question, to me, is reckless. Not raising the question, not raising it, is reckless.
Yeah, it really is. I want to get back to the John Jones test. When the UFC allowed, or they chose to stop allowing those therapeutic use exemptions, you were saying that the testers need to start screening for Clomid, which was one of the estrogen blockers, I believe, Chael tested for back in the day when I saw a tweet. Recently, he said he hit the high score with six. He tested positive for six things at once. It was one of the two things John tested for. Most of our listeners, and frankly myself included, aren't experts when it comes to this stuff. What purpose does Clomid serve to an elite athlete like Jones? And why did you advocate back then that we needed to start testing for it?
Great question. So the reason I advocated for it back then and warned about it before Chael failed was because once they got rid of the therapeutic use exemptions for testosterone, which I was never a fan of, I thought they were being given out too often, too easy to get, and it was basically a hall pass for doping. So I was glad that it went away. The issue, and the reason I raised Clomiphene or Clomid as something to watch out for, is because when an athlete or anybody takes synthetic testosterone, so we're talking about injectable testosterone or testosterone cream, you are taking an artificial form of testosterone and putting it in the body. The body says, oh, wait a second, I already have testosterone. I don't need to keep producing my own. So we have to distinguish. You naturally have testosterone in your body, and then you have this synthetic source of testosterone coming in. So your natural production goes down the longer you're on a synthetic testosterone and the more you're on. So the higher the dosage, the longer the duration, the lower your testosterone levels go. The problem with that is that when you come off the testosterone, the synthetic version, your body doesn't just go back on like a light switch. It doesn't say, oh, no more testosterone, let's just ramp it up and put it into the bloodstream. It takes time. And what Clomid and other estrogen blockers will do is they will, in essence, turbocharge that process. They'll speed up that process, and they'll make the body produce more of its own testosterone quicker than it would if it were doing it on its own. So when you pull testosterone out of the mix, when you have these athletes who are getting these hall passes to use testosterone, it's foreseeable that you're going to see estrogen blockers more prominent in their test results, especially if you're looking for them. And at the time, USADA wasn't doing that testing, the commissions were. And sometimes the commissions weren't that sophisticated in terms of what they should be looking for. And that's why I brought that up at that time. As far as why an athlete like John Jones might be on it, Brock Lesnar, ironically, we hear, failed for the same thing. There's multiple reports of that. So they both failed for Clomiphene, if you believe those reports about Brock, because that hasn't been officially confirmed yet. There's really only three scenarios where an athlete would take Clomid or Clomiphene. One is what I just described, coming off of a cycle and wanting to kick your natural testosterone production up quicker, you would take a Clomid or a Clomiphene. So that's one. The second is during a cycle. A lot of times when athletes take stronger drugs, different testosterones, anadrols, things like that, there's something that takes place in some athletes called aromatization. It basically, there's more water retention. You've heard the phrase gynecomastia, which is in slang referred to as bitch tits, where it looks like a male will have like a little breast tissue around the nipple because of that retention, but it doesn't go away when they come off the drug. So if an athlete is particularly sensitive to the negative side effects of elevated estrogen, which do take place a lot of times when an athlete takes testosterone, they will go on the estrogen blocker to keep the estrogen down while the testosterone, the synthetic testosterone, is in their system. So one scenario is after a cycle, post-cycle therapy. The scenario I just outlined would be during a cycle. Both of these options involve using other drugs beyond an estrogen blocker. The only scenario where you would use only an estrogen blocker that I know of is if you were attempting to boost natural testosterone levels, but it wasn't because you were coming off a cycle. It was just because perhaps your testosterone levels were low, and rather than take injectable or synthetic testosterone, you're trying to boost your natural levels. I will tell you that that is the rarest of the three. The first two scenarios I outlined are very common. The third scenario, because it is known to be inefficient in comparison to just taking testosterone, is not used that often. But it is the one scenario where Jones or Brock may have used the clomiphene, absent a banned substance, et cetera, may have used the clomiphene not connected to any other usage. So that is the only scenario, but it is by far the rarest of the three scenarios.
And this Jones story has been unpacked a little bit. The Jones camp seems adamant that his failed test came from a tainted supplement, much like the Yoel Romero situation, who he, interestingly enough, is also a Malki Kawa client. Do you give much credence to their defense that Jones perhaps innocently took a tainted supplement?
You know, that's a real uphill climb. And the reason it is, first off, the tainted supplement defense is a very tough defense to make out at any point. You have to be able to go find, or USADA has to be able to go find, the same lot. So every batch that's made of a product has like a lot number on it. It means it was all manufactured together. And technically, for that defense to be successful, you have to get another bottle from that lot number, test it, and find the banned substance in it, and the banned substance can't be on the label, because if it was on the label, because keep in mind, not all banned substances are illegal. There are substances that are banned for competition that are perfectly legal. They're not underground anabolic steroids or anything like that. They're just banned substances. So what you're saying with a tainted supplement defense is there was something in that bottle that is not on the bottle, so I had no way of knowing that I was taking something that was banned because it's not marked on the label. In order to make out that defense, let's assume for a moment that they could get the lot and everything else. What makes it so unlikely to me that John will be able to successfully maintain that defense is that he didn't just fail for one banned substance, he failed for two. So now you're going to have to prove that you took supplements that had two different banned substances in them, both of which are drugs. So we're not even talking about a banned substance that is readily available over the counter. We're talking about a banned substance that's a prescription drug. Is it possible? It's possible. Is it likely? To me, it's 1,000 to 1. Because I went back and I found a history of tainted supplements that outlined 850 different tainted supplements. There were about 8 to 10 that were in the what's called aromatase inhibitor category. So if that's all he failed for, you could argue, hey, you know, there was something in those that was defined as an aromatase inhibitor, which kind of works the same as an estrogen blocker. It's a little different, but it's a distinction without a difference for our purposes. I couldn't find one supplement ever that had clomiphene in it or Clomid in it that was tainted with that drug. Not one. I couldn't find one. So if he's able to find a supplement that actually has clomiphene in it, props to him, because it would be, doesn't mean it's never happened, but I could not find a single documented case of a dietary supplement that actually contained clomiphene or Clomid. So that's, to me, it'd be like hitting the lottery for John if he was able to do that. But even if he does do that, well, I'm sure Brock Lesnar would be interested because I'm sure he'd say he took the same thing. He also has to prove the aromatase inhibitor. So he basically has to strike lightning twice. That's going to be really difficult.
I wanted to also ask you about the Chad Mendez situation. It seems like the guy legitimately suffers from plaque psoriasis, a skin condition on his legs. And there are, you know, years-old pictures of him from weigh-ins and fights showing the rashes. So it seems legit. So on surface level, this seems wildly unfair to Chad. Do we need USADA to get more mechanisms in place to protect guys like him who need to take a banned substance to treat a pre-existing medical condition? Or are you not as sympathetic to his defense? What's your take on all this Chad Mendez stuff?
A couple of things. I don't think we need mechanisms because they're already there. You can still apply for a therapeutic use exemption for a banned substance if you have a medically necessary reason to use that substance, right? I mean, you know, again, not all banned substances are, you know, high-end performance-enhancing drugs. Some are more basic things that you just may need because of a medical issue. There's ADD, you know, like attention deficit disorder drugs that are banned substances. So in his case, if he was using this for his psoriasis, that's a perfect scenario where he could go to them in advance and say, I have this medical condition, which he apparently does have. As you say, you go back and look at pictures on his elbows as well. There's images out there of him with the psoriasis. And I know I had a friend who had psoriasis. It's highly annoying, itchy all the time, painful. So I get that you would want to take whatever you could to help that condition. The problem is that if you're using it for that medical purpose, then you have to go make sure that it doesn't have anything in it that's banned. And if it does have something in it that's banned, then you have to get approval before you can use it. Otherwise, you can pop and fail, like what happened to him. The interesting thing is that when I had a source who told me that that's what he failed for, and the source told me that it was a cream and that he did not know that this GHRP6 was in the cream, which I at first thought was a bunch of BS because we have strict labeling laws. To not have it on the label is a stretch. And then I did some searches and actually found a company in Australia that was selling as a cosmetic base for products a plain white tube with nothing on it. And then in the ingredients listed on the box and on the website, it said GHRP6. So I was shocked. The unfortunate thing for Chad is that GHRP6, and this is one of the reasons I rarely buy into the defenses of athletes. You know, a lot of it is dog ate my homework stuff. In his case, GHRP6 is so ineffective as a performance-enhancing drug by itself. The reason it's on the ban list is because to stimulate growth hormone production and get similar benefits to human growth hormone but not take human growth hormone, you would combine GHRP6 with other peptides, and it would ultimately give you that effect. But he didn't test positive for anything else. So either there were other things they didn't catch, or he really took this either not knowing that it was in there or just using it for his psoriasis, and unfortunately it is on the ban list, and it would have done virtually nothing for him from a performance enhancement standpoint, and he's out for 2 years. I mean, if you're going to try to boost performance and you're going to risk failing a test, GHRP6 is among the lowest things on the ladder that you would use.
All right, last question for you. I've got to ask a non-PED question just to show everyone you're not a one-trick pony. Tyron Woodley, your new welterweight champion, when it was all said and done, he said he wanted the money fight against Nick Diaz instead of taking on the guy in Stephen Thompson, who most would probably say is the rightful number one challenger. We saw something very similar last month when Eddie Alvarez voiced his desire to fight Conor McGregor instead of Tony Ferguson or Khabib Nurmagomedov. Do you have any problem with guys going after the big payday instead of taking on the deserving next in line?
I do, and thanks for letting me show something beyond PEDs and USADA issues and calling them out for their foolishness. But And I'll throw one more on the list. How about Michael Bisping fighting Dan Henderson, who's I think ranked 10th. Look, the rankings are worthless. We understand that. The rankings are a joke. I mean, I think Bloody Elbow or Cage Potato, one of the two, did an article like a year and a half ago or a year ago with like dissecting the rankings, and there were media members who were ranking people in the wrong divisions, ranking them in divisions that they hadn't had a fight in a year and a half, all sorts of stuff. So the rankings are a joke, and the UFC knows they're a joke. And Dana White said when they did the rankings that he wasn't going to pay any attention to them to make fights, that he was still going to make the fights the fans wanted to see, etc. So the rankings mean nothing. However, accomplishment and performance, regardless of where a media ranks you, should mean a lot, if not almost everything. And yeah, I guess Nick Diaz is a money fight for Tyrone Woodley more than Stephen Thompson, certainly a less risky fight. But Nick Diaz hasn't won a fight in the UFC since 2011. 5 years. 5 years. And that was BJ Penn fighting at 170 pounds where he absolutely never belonged. He was a legend at 155, and aside from the old days when he fought at 170, before, I would argue, modern MMA made the divisions much more competitive and you couldn't fight. He fought Lyoto Machida at 205 at one point. That could never happen now. That's because the sport was so immature that if you were really good, you could offset some of that weight difference. These days, that's much harder to do. That's his last win for Nick. And, you know, Eddie, I understand everybody wants McGregor, especially after the loss. He looks like easy prey in certain respects. Nate, we'll see if he can handle him a second time. But your history in your division should mean something. And when fighters are now getting accustomed to just calling out fights that they think are going to be the money fights, I understand that they're here to make money. But at the end of the day, it's still supposed to be a sport, and it's still supposed to have some level of what I would call competitive and performance integrity. And if fighters just continue to get the message that he who or she who yells the loudest, insults the most, has the most Twitter followers, is going to get the biggest money fights, I don't think that's the message from a sports standpoint that you want to send. I understand there's an entertainment element. There is. But at the end of the day, you have to make a decision as a promotion whether you're a sport first or you're entertainment first. And it doesn't mean you can't be both sport and entertaining, but what drives your core decisions? Is it performance or Twitter followers? But I guess with CM Punk, a.k.a. Phil Brooks, his real name, fighting in the UFC, having more self-confessed concussions than seconds of actual fight time, I guess Twitter followers is the answer.
Excellently said. His podcast is on the short list of MMA podcasts I recommend to people and can be found online at prommaradio.com. He can be found on Twitter at Larry Pepe, all one word, no underscores. Any other plugs you'd like to get in before we let you go?
Yeah, last thing, Jake, is we are also the voice for the U.S. military, which I'm very proud of, on American Forces Network. The show goes into 170 countries and 150 ships at sea. So if anybody is serving, thank you for your service. Or if you know someone who is serving and they like MMA, you can catch us on American Forces Network. The Voice is the channel. It's the biggest channel that they have. And we are on Saturdays at 5 Pacific.
We appreciate your time and hope to chat with you again down the road sometime. Thanks again, Larry.
Sounds good to me, Jake. Thanks for having me on.